World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Trout.
Units of the United States fleet are in Sagami Bay, the body of water through which ships must pass to reach Tokyo Bay. From the place where these two bays join, the city limits of Tokyo are only 22 miles away. But there's no news yet on how far up Sagami Bay the American warships have steamed, nor is there word of how many ships or what types have detached themselves from the great fleet of 400 now standing off the coast to enter the inland waters of Japan. Columbia's correspondent, Gene Ryder, with the fleet, said about an hour ago it appeared the fleet would move into Tokyo Bay within a few hours. General MacArthur, the Supreme Allied Commander, is proceeding with plans that have been kept fluid. Changes can be made quickly in details without upsetting the basic arrangements for the occupation. We've already seen some changes due to weather, and it's possible that more may be necessary before the entire program has been carried out. The Japanese, perhaps because of their damaged communication facilities, seem to be having a hard time keeping up with the shifts in the timetable. Tokyo has notified headquarters in Manila that the Japanese vessel, which was supposed to meet the American fleet units and guide them through Sagami Bay, was not on hand at the scheduled time and place. According to Tokyo, the pilot vessel received the message that the occupation had been postponed for 48 hours, but did not receive the later message that the fleet units would enter Sagami Bay Sunday, Japanese time. Therefore, Tokyo says, the Japanese vessel turned back. But there's no reason to believe that the absence of the pilot vessel disrupted Admiral Halsey's plans. Apparently, the American warships have gone right ahead just as they had intended. And when next heard from, there's little doubt that the ships of the United States Navy will be closer to the city of Tokyo than they have ever been since Japan entered the Second World War. This incident seems typical of the entire procedure for entering and occupying the country of the enemy. Sudden changes have to be made. Storms blow up out of the Pacific. Airfields become unsafe for landings. The Japanese announce that they are unable to fulfill some requirement or other. Messages are sent out and vanish without reaching their destination. Apparently, the Japanese either are not used to moving with such speed and efficiency, or the ravages of war are hampering their movements more than had been expected. But despite all the difficulties in making the details fit together, the broad program moves on. The vast Allied war machine closes in on the enemy's home islands, and the great moment draws inexorably closer. There's no evidence that the Japanese are now deliberately delaying. At first, that was the tactic the enemy used. But a week ago, when the Japanese representatives reached Manila, it was the Supreme Allied Commander who set the pace for the operations to follow. From last Sunday on, General MacArthur has determined how swiftly the Allied armed forces should move toward Japan. The timetable since then has depended on his judgment, taking into consideration such factors as the weather, the ability of the Japanese to carry out their instructions properly and promptly, and the complicated maneuvering necessary to bring the Allied troops and ships and planes at full strength into the Japanese homeland in a certain order. The Allied military commanders can be trusted to guard against Japanese treachery as the moment of signing the document approaches. But today the Russian publication Pravda warns the Allies of a different, more subtle treachery which can be guarded against by the Allied statesmen rather than the soldiers and sailors. Pravda says that Japan's ruling clique is trying to repeat the 1918 tactics of the German General Staff, shielding war criminals, preserving their staffs and their machinery. In other words, says the Moscow paper, they intend to prepare revenge. And now for our first switch abroad. For a report from General MacArthur's headquarters, Admiral takes you to CBS Manila, George Murad reporting.
From all we can gather in Manila this Monday morning, the next few days before the various occupation forces actually land are going to be even more hectic and confused than during the past week. But it must be remembered that a sprawling empire has collapsed, and the result is a scramble. It's all strangely reminiscent of the collapse of Germany and the Balkans. A few questions about who will administer the Far East and how seem to be getting a bit clearer. Hong Kong will be occupied by a British fleet, landing in the next couple of days. And the Chinese, while they reserve their right to a later claim on the Crown Colony, will not enter with their troops. We've had a message from Shanghai saying that an advance group of Americans has arrived. Chinese troops are policing the city, and Allied prisoners of war have or shortly will be released. Many of these prisoners were moved up from Hong Kong. Japanese sentries are still standing guard in the settlement, but merely waiting to surrender. The report says Shanghai is almost untouched by war. That's extremely good news and almost unbelievable after one has looked at the shambles of Manila and considered what conditions in much-bombed Tokyo must be. It means that the Chinese will have at least one large industrial city and the most important port in the Orient with which to start rebuilding their nation. General Wiedemeyer says that American Army headquarters will be set up in Shanghai, which bodes well for continued lend-lease. America is also going to have some interest in what happens farther north. Although the Red Army is still fighting on Sakhalin Island, has occupied a considerable part of Korea, and is pushing deep into Manchuria, General MacArthur announced a few hours ago that the 24th United States Army Corps will land in Korea, south of 38 degrees north latitude. It thus appears that General Hodges' men will occupy approximately the southern half of Korea, perhaps at the port of Jeonju and including the important city of Busan. This area lies in the same latitude as Weihaiwei, Shifu, and Qingdao, the former British and American naval bases in the Gulf of Chile. In these hectic days, there is reason for sober consideration about how the interests of the big four powers are going to be solved with reasonable justice. Some of the pessimists here believe in the absence of a clear assurance from Russia that the boundaries of influence are going to be set by whose troops got where first. Some people feel, in view of the principal burden which Americans carried in this war, that we're being just a little shy now. Admiral Spruance told us yesterday that America would not seek to establish bases on the Asiatic coast and probably not on Formosa, due to what he calls the danger of political involvement. This is George Murad in Manila. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney.
Complete victory over Japan has brought a lot closer your dream of owning an Admiral radio phonograph with an automatic record changer. You're going to enjoy loading your Admiral automatic record changer with 10 or 12 of your favorite records and hearing them perfectly played one after another without any long waits in between. This will be possible for the first time because the new Admiral changer will change records in 5 seconds. That's right, just 5 seconds. The closing strains of one selection will hardly have died away before the next one will begin. Your Admiral will give you complete enjoyment of recorded music at its best. There'll be other improvements, too. Fewer moving parts assure longer life to your Admiral record changer. Featherlight tone arm makes possible noiseless reproduction and high fidelity of tone. Admiral will give you new cabinet beauty and styling, too. So plan now to make your dream come true. For a radio phonograph with the best of everything for your listening pleasure, own an Admiral, America's smart set. Now here once again is Robert Trout.
Next, for a recording made by CBS correspondent Gene Ryder from a battleship off Japan, Admiral takes you to San Francisco.
The fleet has been ready since DJ Day to go ahead with its part of occupying Japan. Its landing force has been standing by, and a large fleet of minesweepers has been waiting to enter Tokyo Harbor. It's known that there are several hundred mines around the harbor, but the minesweeper men expect to have far more trouble with American mines dropped by B-29. But due to delays elsewhere, the Fleet Landing Force, the Third Fleet, and the British Pacific Fleet have been patrolling around off Tokyo long enough to wear a groove in the ocean. But now, after one false start, it looks as though the Navy's first phase of this operation will start within a few hours. And as you know, the whole operation means a seizure of the Yokosuka Naval Base 39 miles south of Tokyo. The fleet is all set to transform that base and Tokyo Harbor overnight into an American naval base and harbor. The typhoon that caused the delay in flights of airborne troops to Japan hasn't interfered with the fleet as it moves ahead. For the first time since VJ Day, planes from Third Fleet's Carrier Task Force 38 are keeping an air umbrella over Tokyo and eastern Honshu. The primary mission of the Navy pilots is to seek out prisoner of war camps, and according to reports from carriers, a number of camps have been located. Large numbers of prisoners were seen yesterday waving up at the low-flying Navy pilots. Flyers say they've encountered no Japanese opposition of any kind in their patrols over the homeland. This is Gene Ryder with the Third Fleet off Tokyo. I return you to Admiral, New York.
In Washington, congressional committees are preparing hearings on the future of atomic energy. For details, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
Some of America's best brains will try to peer down the dark and lonely corridors of the future. The long official silence on atomic energy will be lifted just enough for the world to get a glimpse of a new era. The scene, one of the stately white marble hearing rooms in the Senate office building. The characters, the Senate Military Affairs and Commerce Committee sitting as a jury. Scientists, generals, industrialists, labor leaders, and cabinet members will plead their cases. The narrow specific issue is the future of scientific research in the United States. The science bill, which will be discussed at these hearings, calls for continued federal research in peacetime. But the broad ethical question is, what is man going to do with these terrible forces he has unleashed upon the world? Already, bitter debate is raging behind the scenes in Washington over who will control research and development of atomic power. The War Department has squatter's rights. It controls atomic research now and has no intention of releasing it. In fact, the War Department is drawing up a bill which stakes out its claim. The Army position is quite simple. Atomic energy is the most destructive force known to man. Thus, it must be tightly controlled by those whose business is death and destruction. A sharply opposite view is taken by a group of senators, including Kilgore and Pepper, and Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace. They say that atomic power should be used to better mankind, that the government should turn over its cruel inventions for war to constructive purposes, that funds should be provided to put all the best scientific minds of the country at work on this program. Still a third view is beginning to show its head in Washington, to turn control of atomic power over to the Social and Economic Council of the United Nations. Those who favor this argue that the secrets of atomic power will be open to the world in a matter of a few years anyway. President Truman is keenly aware of the conflicts over atomic power and has indicated he is not sold on the Army position. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Admiral takes you to Chung King, Ed Sauter, Jr. reporting.
This is Ed Sauter, Jr. in Chung King. 2 days ago, the legislative branch of the government of China ratified the new Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship and Alliance. The terms of that treaty have now been made public. Here is a brief summary of the principal clauses. 1. Soviet Russia agrees to render China moral and material assistance in the form of military and other supplies. Such assistance is to be given exclusively to the government of Chiang Kai-shek. 2. Soviet Russia reaffirms her respect for China's full sovereignty in Manchuria. 3. China agrees to recognize the full independence of Outer Mongolia if, after a plebiscite, the Mongolian people indicate their desire for such independence. 4. The principal Manchurian railways are now combined into one line, to be jointly owned and operated by China and the USSR for a period of 40 years, after which time the entire railway shall revert to China without additional payment. 5. The Chinese government declares Dairen a free port, open to the shipping of all nations. The port shall remain free for 30 years. 6. Port Arthur is to be used jointly by China and Russia as a naval base. It will revert fully to China in 30 years. And finally, the Soviets give promise that within 3 weeks of Japanese capitulation, they will start withdrawing their troops from Manchuria. This is Ed Sauder, Jr. speaking from Chungking.
This is Don Mosley of the CBS Shortwave Monitoring Staff in San Francisco. Whenever the Japanese begin to talk about how calm and unruffled they are in the face of some emergency, you can be pretty certain that actually they're just the reverse. And today it's clear that the Japs have a bad case of occupation jitters. The people are utterly calm, said Tokyo in one breath in a broadcast beamed to this country. But 5 minutes later, the Jap radio was telling its own people, we must absolutely avoid unnecessary confusion and become completely calm, even though Allied planes are flying over our heads. The Japanese, in fact, seem to be having trouble assessing their own frame of mind in this crisis. The first reaction to the Emperor's surrender rescript was vast excitement and confusion. The decision to quit the war came as a profound shock to perhaps the vast majority of Japanese, and as the Jap broadcast told us, many a Japanese army man resented and disapproved. There seems little doubt now that the Emperor's prestige in those first few days met its gravest and most precarious test since Japan's Middle Ages. But whatever doubt there may have been at first, the Emperor's potency as a ruling force has now proved itself, and there's little doubt that the peace policy as a whole will prevail. The period since the Jap announcement accepting surrender has been a busy one for the old familiar group of war-guilty Japanese government leaders. They have used all the facilities available, including Tokyo Radio, to try and convince the world of their piety. These men who led the Japs to war and perpetrated Japan's worst crimes would now have us believe they are best fitted to rule Japan in the post-war era. This past week, they have tried with little success to sweep a vast amount of dirt under the rug. The tone of almost all the enemy broadcasts has been one of smug non-repentance, reflecting the mad scramble of those unchanged leaders to save their own hides. The attempt, fortunately, has been quite transparent, and with the fleet now preparing to enter Tokyo Bay, we should be hearing Radio Tokyo sing a much different tone in a very short time. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a report from London, where the abrupt ending of Lend-Lease is making the biggest news. Admiral takes you to London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
The great British liner, Queen Elizabeth, sailed out of Southampton today with 15,000 American soldiers aboard bound for New York. Time was when such transportation cost the United States government nothing, but was written off against Lend-Lease. Now that Lend-Lease has been canceled, reverse Lend-Lease has been canceled too, and presumably the United States will have to pay the passage of every American soldier brought home in a British ship. British economists are today pointing out that the termination of Lend-Lease cuts both ways. Besides reverse Lend-Lease goods and services like passage on the Queen Elizabeth, there is the larger and more complicated question of world trade in general. Next to Canada, Great Britain is America's biggest customer. If, as some economists say, full employment and prosperity in America depend on foreign trade, then we cannot afford to lose the British market. But with the sudden termination of Lend-Lease and the emphasis on dollar payments for everything they buy, the British say they may be forced to buy as little as possible from the United States and to concentrate on barter agreements and deals within the empire. That is, of course, just what we don't want. The whole American policy is toward freer trade. That's the economist's way of looking at it. But let me tell you a little about the confused point of view of the British civilian. With the sudden end of the war, he sees the end of the share and share-alike spirit with which the war was won and which was held up as an imperishable ideal. Now he has to get back to the old every-man-for-himself ideal. He is morally confused. He doesn't want anything he doesn't deserve, but on the other hand, during the war, lend-lease wasn't charity, and he can't see that things are really very different now. It is, perhaps, that the whole concept of lend-lease was a little too big for our times. This is Charles Collingwood in London, returning you to Admiral in New York.
France today is watching the progress of General de Gaulle's visit to the United States. Admiral takes you now to CBS Paris, Douglas Edwards reporting.
We are very good friends now, is it not so? That's what a Frenchman said to me this morning. He'd been following very closely General de Gaulle's visit to President Truman, and although there's been an undercurrent of feeling that perhaps the mission might not have been so successful as has been documented or hoped, it still has not failed. And he seemed to think that France may at least have pulled alongside of England in America's affection. I found that to be a France is confident of some help from America. Food, perhaps some coal, machinery, textiles, and clothing. And on that subject, I know where you can buy here in Paris one faded red sweater made of ersatz yarn and second hand. I know where that woman's sweater, which is several years old, can be purchased for 56 American dollars in the working class neighborhood of Paris. But not everybody has that information, and the trees are beginning to turn brown in spots along the Seine. And still the French are hopeful of a helping hand, and they're not depressed at the news from Washington concerning the de Gaulle trip. Now, here's something America has been told and told time and again while this war has been going on. Write letters. Send packages to the boys overseas. I'd like to punch that one home again and again, now, even with more vigor than in the past, because now is a very critical time over here in Europe. The war is over. The men are not idle, but they're not very busy. They have a great deal more spare time on their hands. And most of all, they're in danger of a tremendous boredom and impatience. Because they're sweating it out. They're sweating out the biggest event in their lives in many years, and that is getting home and getting out of the army. So take it from somebody who sees the boys every day, who chats with them while they're on leave here in Paris. Keep those letters coming. They're even more vital now than they were a year ago. And this is Douglas Edwards in Paris, returning to Admiral in New York.
And now to tell you about a new kind of refrigerator with a built-in ultraviolet ray lamp to kill bacteria, here is Warren Sweeney.
It's the Sterilamp in the post-war Admiral dual-temp refrigerator. Low temperatures alone cannot always prevent foods from spoiling. Mold and gradual decay are proof that bacteria are present. But in the Admiral dual-temp, the scientific Sterilamp destroys bacteria on exposed food surfaces and in the surrounding air. Foods will stay fresh and wholesome for a longer period. The ultraviolet rays from the Sterilamp are as safe as sunshine. Their sanitizing action retards mold growth, reduces spoilage due to bacteria, and neutralizes offensive odors. You'll find Sterilamp in the post-war Admiral Dual Temp, the refrigerator that is really two refrigerators in one. But to find out more about Sterilamp and other exclusive features of the Admiral Dual Temp, as well as Admiral radios and other Admiral major appliances, why don't you write today for Admiral's new, highly colored, free booklet entitled It's a Promise from Admiral. To get your copy, simply write your name and address on a penny postcard, then mail it to Admiral in care of the radio station to which you're now listening. Well, that's easy, isn't it? Just your name and address mailed to Admiral in care of this station. The demands on the nation's food supply are greater than ever this year. Farmers have been asked to continue their high rate of food production, and they need help. 4 million part-time farm workers are needed to help harvest the 1945 crop. Part-time work will draw prevailing farm wages. Everyone, with or without farm experience, men, women, boys, or girls, can help with as much time as they can spare. Get in touch with your county agricultural agent or your local farm employment office immediately. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago. The following announcement is transcribed.
World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented on behalf of Admiral dealers all over America by shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country. On this VJ Day, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Prout.
Japan has surrendered, thus submitting the four home islands to the forces of occupation and renouncing the stolen empire overseas. The occupation troops are moving in gradually, slowly extending the area under Allied control. The latest to go ashore were American troops from the 1st Cavalry Division, who stepped out of their small landing craft onto the beach near Yokohama as a military band played and Japanese soldiers, demobilized and apparently bound for home, straggled past. Thousands of miles from Japan, the Japanese forces are slowly yielding the territory they had thought to rule forever. In the Central Pacific, the chief of staff of the Japanese 4th Fleet climbed aboard the American light cruiser Portland and surrendered the garrison of once formidable Truk. Wake, Nauru, Ponape remain to be heard from. Their surrender cannot be long delayed. General Yamashita, who liked to call himself the Tiger of Malaya, flew into the Philippine city of Baguio today with a staff of 20 to go through a ceremony surrendering his northern Philippine survivors tomorrow. Columbia's correspondent John Adams, who had an exclusive interview with Yamashita, reports that the Japanese general, when asked why he does not kill himself, roared with laughter, shook his head, and said, "No, no harakiri." We'll have later news from John Adams in the Philippines during this broadcast. For the moment, perhaps it's not out of place to observe that very few high-ranking Japanese have killed themselves, despite all the talk of Japanese traditions and sacred customs. The one really high official who took his own life at news of the surrender was the war minister, Anami. The glory of suicide in the face of disaster is supposed to be a Japanese conception, but the truth is that a greater number of high-ranking Germans chose that way out. In all the propaganda that the Tokyo Radio and the Dome Agency have been sending out during the nearly 3 weeks since the first surrender announcement, there's been no mention of the reason why the custom of harakiri has been shunned by the majority of Japan's leaders. Perhaps the reason, if there is one beyond the ordinary instinct of self-preservation, will become more visible as time passes. In Southeast Asia, the British East Indies fleet and the convoys of transports are ready to steam through the Straits of Malacca and to the peninsula of Malaya, the British base of Singapore, and the Dutch island of Sumatra. But much work remains to be done first. Today, the minesweepers, which have been at sea continuously since the 15th of August, waiting for the moment, took up their task at dawn, and for the next few days, they'll be clearing the lane of safe water for the procession of ships that will follow. In Moscow, the Soviet government announced that Russia will observe VJ Day tomorrow. Generalissimo Stalin sent a message of congratulation to President Truman and made a broadcast to the Russian people. Stalin traced Japan's career of aggression from the attack on Russia's warships at Port Arthur 41 years ago. He compared this treacherous attack with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, said the Port Arthur treachery had left grave memories in the minds of the Russian people, but the stain has now been wiped out. In some detail, Generalissimo Stalin spoke of Japan's persistent attempt to block Russia's entry into the Pacific by seizing the southern part of Sakhalin Island and tightening the grip on the Kuril chain and by frequently invading Russian territory. It was plain, said Stalin, that Japan set herself the aim of wresting from Russia her entire Far East. But now Japan is routed. Southern Sakhalin and the Kuril Islands will pass to the Soviet Union. We have lived through hard years, he said, but now the conditions necessary for the peace of the world have been won. Glory to the armed forces of the Soviet Union, the United States of America, China, and Great Britain, which have won over Japan. And now for a recorded report by Columbia's correspondent John Adams from Baguio in the Philippines, Admiral takes you to CBS San Francisco.
This is John Adams speaking by remote pickup over Signal Corps facilities from Baguio in northern Luzon. General Tomoyuki Yamashita, commanding all remaining Japanese army forces on Luzon, is sleeping tonight between seats on a spring bed on the second floor of this old colonial mansion, the former High Commissioner's residence. I cannot say how soundly the paunchy general is sleeping, but I can say that tonight, on the eve of his surrender, he is not suffering from loss of appetite. I stood in the kitchen here a few hours ago talking with one of the cooks, T4 Alex Demers of Cloquet, Minnesota, as he fried up a dozen juicy steaks for Yamashita and members of his staff. They were seated at a large table in the mahogany-paneled but bullet-scarred dining room, with Yamashita in a roomy armchair. After a bowl of vegetable soup and a big steak, mashed potatoes, peas, bread and butter, and three glasses of ice water, the general asked for beer, and got it, as did the other two generals and two admirals at his table. Then hungry Yamashita ate a large piece of chocolate cake, an apple, and a banana, smoked a cigarette, and took another glass of ice water. A short time later, he asked the MT guard outside his room for more ice water. Major Aubrey Kenworthy of the MP command commented, "It has evidently been a long time since the one-time Tiger of Maloa and the more recently Gopher of Luzon has lived so well." Of course, BJ Day had been a long, strenuous day for Yamashita. He had been carried 7 miles in a comfortable sedan chair in the early morning, had then traveled for an hour down steep mountain roads in a truck, then flew 100 miles in an Army C-47 plane, and then had suffered a three-hour, paunch-shaking ride in the Jeep up to Baguio. I traveled in the 12-Jeep convoy, and as we disembarked here, I offered him a cigarette, which he quickly accepted. Later, I asked him in one- and two-syllable words, "You happy, General? War now over?" He understood and grunted approval, adding, "Yes, happy, happy." And his yellow, flaccid face broke into a half smile. He also answered in the negative when I jokingly asked him if he planned to commit harakiri. No harakiri, he answered, and had quite a laugh over the question with Major General Utsana Miya, his assistant chief of staff. Utsana Miya speaks good English, having lived abroad in the States as well as South America and China. He said that all the world was happy the war was over, and added, "We must have peace always, now." An MP took a dim view on the whole proceedings a little earlier when he discovered a live grenade in the pocket of one of the orderlies. "It's a heck of a thing," he said, "to come to a peace conference with a live grenade." This is John Adams speaking from Baguio in northern Luzon.
And now to hear from one of Columbia's correspondents with the fleet in Tokyo Bay, Admiral takes you to Japan. Webley Edwards reporting.
We have been at peace with Japan for some hours now, but already the machinery is moving toward a full-scale occupation of the empire. Thus far, the occupation forces had only established naval and military bases in the Tokyo, Yokohama, Yokosuka area. The signing of the formal surrender would be the signal for hundreds of thousands of occupation troops to start moving toward assigned occupation zones throughout Japan. The Navy has announced that Japanese warships that still are in existence may be manned temporarily by Japanese crews, but they'll gradually be taken over. An interesting sidelight is, it's customary for the Navy to issue a roster of all ships in harbor, giving the ship's number, the date of arrival, and the nationality. Tonight's list from the U.S. Port Director for Tokyo Harbor lists, along with such great warships as the Missouri, the Iowa, and the Duke of York, the following. Battleship Nagato, ex-NIP, no number, date of arrival already here. Ashore, civilian communications and transportation are functioning pretty much as usual. although closely policed. SyncPak has issued a firm order against looting. The order says that looting and other acts contrary to standards of human decency will not be tolerated. But lest the Japanese come to think that common American decency is a sign of softness for them, the order further says that the occupation will be lawful and the terms will be uncompromisingly enforced and justice will characterize the administration. But, it says, the Japanese will not be allowed to forget they were defeated and are paying the penalty for aggression and treachery. The order against fraternizing with a vanquished enemy has been plainly given to all troops. I don't expect we'll have a problem there, as was experienced in Germany. The one thing most Japanese girls I've seen here so far have been mainly concerned with getting indoors and out of sight the minute they saw an American.
That was Webley Edwards with the fleet in Tokyo Bay. We return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney.
Soon you'll be able to walk into your Admiral dealer's store and confidently buy the style radio or radio phonograph you want. The selection of Admiral radios will be complete. There'll be radio phonographs with the famous Admiral exclusive features, slide away that makes loading and unloading your record changer so easy, and the foolproof Admiral automatic record changer. There'll be consoles and table models and newly designed cabinets of fine woods and modern plastics. There'll be farm sets and portables in many styles and sizes, including the popular Admiral Bantam, the camera-type radio that operates on alternating current, direct current, or self-contained batteries. There'll be new electronic refinements and AM, FM, and shortwave reception. And now about television. Admiral's extensive research assures television receivers with true Admiral quality. So, whatever you want in radio, you'll find it in an Admiral, America's smart set. You can get a very good idea of what Admiral will offer if you're right for a free copy of the new full-colored booklet entitled It's a Promise from Admiral. Just write your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral in care of this radio station. That's all. Just your name and address mailed to Admiral at this station. Now, here once again is Robert Trout.
Now for a note on the unprecedented surrender of Japan, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The surrender of Japan is without precedent in more ways than one. It's without precedent, for one thing, in Japanese history. Never before has so much as a Japanese company surrendered as a unit, let alone the whole empire and all its forces. But the surrender of Japan is also the first instance in history in which a nation has been compelled to yield without the defeat of its army. It is the classic last analysis of sea power. An insular state lost the command of the sea and was forced into surrender as a result. In this respect, the situation of Japan is not unlike that of Great Britain. Both are highly industrialized countries, dependent on the sea for the raw materials and food which they cannot produce at home. Japan produces more food than Britain, but neither produces any of the enormous list of industrial raw materials except coal. In 1917, students of the last war will perhaps recall, Admiral Lord Jellicoe told the British War Cabinet that unless something effective could be done about the U-boat, the war was lost for Britain. The adoption and success of the convoy system came just in time. In this war, the danger to Britain was almost as great from the same source. In effect, the interruption of our sea communications by German submarines, but it was averted because of the increasing amount of American aid that became available in protecting the life-bringing convoys. Japan, however, fully as dependent as Britain on open sea lanes, could never manage to give those sea lanes the same degree of protection. Her navy was not as efficient as the British, and she was not able to produce enough ships and planes to do the job against the steadily rising tide of American sea power. Her rulers showed true appreciation of her strategic situation when they struck their first blow at Pearl Harbor against the American Navy. The blow was a shattering one, but American recovery from it was quicker than the Japanese had expected. As the United States recovered, gradually but steadily, the command of the sea, and by the same token deprived the Japanese of the ability to use the sea for their military and economic requirements, Just in that measure, the Japanese began to lose the war. They had counted on the protection of distance. It did not avail them. They had planned a defensive policy, but they were basing their hopes on a faulty analysis of the history of sea power, in which the defensive role is always the forerunner of defeat. It was sea power which brought the atomic bombs and the B-29s within reach of Japanese vitals. It was sea power which applied the pressures of blockade which prevented the Japanese from defending themselves adequately. It is fitting indeed the ceremony of surrender should have taken place on board an American battleship and that the American representative should have been the commander-in-chief of the American naval forces in the Pacific. Now here again is Robert Trout.
Next, a report from our own capital. Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
Tonight, shortly after 9 o'clock Eastern wartime, President Truman will broadcast a special message to our armed forces. It will be carried by shortwave to every corner of the globe. Gaunt and hungry Americans, freed from Japanese prison camps, will hear this expression of their country's gratitude. Wounded men in military and naval hospitals will listen through earphones. The program will be carried in this country by CBS. And at 11:15 tonight, over many of these same stations, CBS will present a documentary of the war from Pearl Harbor to the end. Last night, I stood just a few feet from President Truman, and he and his guests listened to the surrender broadcast from Japan, and I couldn't help but notice how he has grown grayer and more sober in the few months at the White House. The quick, friendly smile is as ready as ever, but more often now he appears lost in thought. The clear eyes behind the horn-rimmed spectacles are focused off in the distance. The mouth is tightly closed, and the jaw jutted forward just a bit. The president, too, seems more positive, more sure of himself. To make a comparison, being president is like a man who has stepped apart from the crowd, climbed to a high, lonely mountaintop. There he must face the winds of fate and make the decision affecting the lives of millions. Harry Truman tries to break the isolation of his office. Every once in a while, he gets on the phone, calls his good friend Les Biffle, Secretary of the Senate. Les, the president will say, I'm coming up for lunch. Get some of the boys together. The boys, Mr. Truman's old friends in the Senate, are the most powerful single force in the administration. There is every sign, for example, that Mr. Truman will adopt the reconversion program of the liberal wing of the Democrats in the Senate. Senator Kilgore of West Virginia, one of the leaders of this bloc, is a regular visitor to the White House. These policies have been approved generally by such moderates as Democratic floor leader Alvin Barkley. The plan calls for passage of the full employment bill, expanded Social Security, a gigantic housing boom, and a regional resources program. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Great Britain today is looking back on 6 years of war. For a report, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
It was another Sunday 6 years ago today that this war began for the British. The British Prime Minister, who was then Neville Chamberlain, read the declaration of war on Germany. His voice was uncertain. Everything was uncertain in those days. There was a phony air raid alarm a few minutes later, and all the brand new air raid wardens rushed out in yellow slickers to ward off gas attacks and drove everyone off the streets. No one knew what was coming. And in Britain, the question everyone asked was, how about America? What will America do? Today, 6 years later, the war is over. Germany is beaten, and Japan, too. America became Britain's closest and most powerful ally. But today, everyone is uncertain. And in Britain, the question everyone is asking is, how about America? What will America do? More than they did 6 years ago, the British relate every problem with which they're confronted to America. 6 years ago, Britain was proud and rich and bestrode the world. America was an unknown factor. Today it is America's shadow which spreads across the world, and the British are having a hard time adjusting to being in anybody's shade. There are two schools of thought in Britain. One is that Britain must attach herself to the United States, become a sort of junior partner of ours. The other is that she must stand up to America, compete with her, beat the United States at her own game. There's a tremendous clamor in Britain today to stop buying things from the United States and to concentrate on trade within the empire. Lord Beaverbrook's newspapers lead the way. His Sunday Express launches a campaign today to stop buying gasoline, movies, and cigarettes from America and to replace the American products with things produced in the British Empire. The cancellation of Lend-Lease, which the British call End-Lease or Cease-Lend, now has brought them to an uncomfortable realization of not only how much they owe America, but how dependent they are on America. At the moment, they're wavering between trying to reach an agreement with the United States or retiring into the closed circle of empire trade. The whole future of Anglo-American relations is more in the balance today than it ever was. This is Charles Collingwood in London, returning you to Admiral in New York.
France is observing VJ Day today. And for a direct report from France, Admiral takes you to CBS Paris. Douglas Edwards reporting.
In Paris, VJ Day official has been the same as any other Sunday. There was an international track meet in which the cinder stars of France met the cinder stars of Britain and won by mile. And everybody is glad the signature is on the dotted line, but otherwise there is nothing special, just quiet Thanksgiving. General John Cannon, the commander of the American Air Forces in Europe, hits the keynote with a statement on victory in the Pacific. And what he says, we greet with the same joy and hope for the future as our comrades in arms in the Far East. And he points to the jobs of his command yet unfinished in Europe. Among them, disarmament of the German Air Force, the scrutiny of additional developments of German scientists, and of course the Air Force must carry its full share of the burden of policing Germany. This weekend has been going home time for 15,800 American troops who left Marseille in the largest USA-bound shipment yet to leave that port. Many of them are High Point men, and 11,000 of the 17th Airborne Division began moving into the Marseille area today. The French are being given nearly 6,500 excess army trucks within the next 10 days. The transfer will be carried out under commitments made before cancellation of Lend-Lease, and the authority has been given to go ahead with the deal. Minister of Justice Pierre Tegan reports that the war and the Nazi occupation cost France half her national wealth, $98 billion. And in that line of thought, there is considerable opinion here in Paris that the American credits extended to France during General de Gaulle's visit to Washington and estimated unofficially to amount to about $640 million are really only a starter. France is believed to require something approximating $1 billion for her reconstruction, and French officials believe she'll be granted aid in that amount by the Washington government. And this is Douglas Edwards in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
A dispatch from Rome tells us that former Prime Minister Winston Churchill of Great Britain will spend a 10-day rest period in northern Italy, golfing and possibly painting, at a villa in the Lake Como region. Mr. Churchill arrived in northern Italy yesterday, where he'll be a guest of Field Marshal Sir Harold Alexander. He'll forego any political talks and anything pertaining to official business as leader of His Majesty's opposition during his holiday period. To avoid any suggestion of official status, Mr. Churchill is traveling through Italy under a pseudonym. Dispatches from Milan say that Mr. Churchill arrived aboard an airplane yesterday and briefly toured Milan. Surprised Milanese cheered him wildly. And now to tell you about a new kind of refrigerator with a built-in freezing locker, here is Warren Sweeney.
It's Dual Temp by Admiral. Really, two refrigerators in one. The built-in freezing locker in your new Admiral will actually quick-freeze meats, fruits, or vegetables. And it will store up to 80 pounds of frozen food safely for months. Yes, the Admiral Dual Temp is really two refrigerators in one. For besides the built-in freezing locker, there's a huge moist cool compartment for the regular storage of foods. And it never has to be defrosted. That's right, you never defrost it. This Admiral Moist Cold Compartment is roomier, too, because there are no messy, frost-covered coils to take valuable food storage space. But to get all the facts and features about your new Admiral Dual Temp, as well as Admiral radios, Admiral electric ranges, and Admiral home freezers, why not write today for a new free booklet called It's a Promise from Admiral? All you have to do is write your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral in care of the radio station to which you are now listening. That's all. Your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral. You'll get a copy right away. It's a promise from Admiral. The need for buying and holding war bonds is still acute. For the hundreds of thousands of sick and wounded fighting men who need medical care, the war will not be over for a long time. Besides providing this medical attention, war bonds can combat the danger of inflation and protect the nation against a post-war depression. War bonds are still your best investment. Buy all you can and hold them. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago. The following announcement is transcribed.